July of 2009, the city of Windsor reported an unemployment rate of 15.4%. A city that was a key hub of the auto manufacturing sector in Ontario was facing major challenges. The big three, Ford, Chrysler, and GM, were laying off staff and closing plants.
For generations, this is what southwestern Ontario looked like, a big plant with lots of jobs. And from London and Windsor to Woodstock, it served people here pretty well. Now, though, it's getting harder and harder to find a good job at a plant like this. With so much manufacturing winding down, this region finds itself at something of a crossroads. Where do people need to turn to regain the lost time, jobs, and opportunity?
For Rust Belt cities like Windsor, manufacturing was the backbone of the economy, employing thousands of blue-collar workers, workers that went out for dinner at the local restaurants, workers that shopped at grocery stores, and workers that paid taxes to City Hall.
It's a great disappointment that we learned of the closure of the H.J. Heinz plant here in Leamington after 104 years of its existence.
But since the economic crash, Windsor and other mid-sized cities across Ontario are feeling the squeeze. The economies of these cities are not as stable anymore, and without jobs, young people are leaving. Mid-sized cities like Windsor, Cambridge, and Sarnia are struggling with declining populations or limited growth. For cities, growth provides the opportunity to finance investment and for planners to make change through progressive plans. Can planners and cities adapt to the new economic reality? How can planners chart a new future for the industrial heartland of Ontario? Can we find new ways to attract people and development? Is there a new identity for these mid-sized cities?
From pennies to pipes. Coming up, the real cost of development. How our current financing mechanisms are working against our planning policies and bankrupting our municipal coffers. The story of one municipality's fight against this and how it's financing the retrofit of a new urban center in the suburbs. Facing a recession, we'll learn how a depressed city is using innovative tools to climb out of the red, and how one man's ordinary acts are doing extraordinary things to help them do it.
We'll learn what other financial tools planners can use to make lemons into lemonade, to diversify their economies, build social spaces and social capital, to get renewable energy projects off the ground, and get us moving safer, faster, and greener. In this episode, we explore planning with sense. I'm Ross Sauer.
And I'm Danielle Davis.
And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a Planning and Design Center production. This is an OPPI episode.
OPPI is the recognized voice of the province's planning profession. There are more than 4,000 members work in government, private practice, universities, and not-for-profit agencies in the fields of urban and rural development, community design, social services, heritage conservation, housing, economic development, and more.
I've actually been told by one developer that he's surprised that planners don't understand how much it costs to build something.
Well, I mean, I guess he has a point, but let's see. It's pretty straightforward. Can't be that hard to figure out. You need a development site, right? And some kind of spreadsheety thing to project the costs? To make sure this thing is actually financially viable? I think that's called a proforma. Say, developer Smith is looking to develop an empty corner lot in an urban neighborhood in Ottawa. How does she do a proforma?
essentially it starts off with the land. The developer has to either own the land or find or secure the land. The land is probably the key component in this process that drives the overall feasibility of a project.
Next, you take the site on Gentrification Avenue and try to understand what the current planning regulations will allow you to do with the site.
Then they'll do their background due diligence and see what the existing planning regulations and policies will allow in terms of development.
Then they'll look and see if anyone is interested in buying condos on Gentrification Avenue in this neighborhood.
We'll also do a market analysis to see what might be appropriate for, you know, like, to meet the market needs.
From there, it gets a little more detailed and less hypothetical. Ms. Smith really starts sharpening her pencil, trying to understand the market.
Once that's done, then they'll go, they'll probably do an initial run even before the, like, initial cut, before they do anything else. Like, they'll figure out, based on the market, based on planning, and also comparables, what's going on in the area, what can we build? You know, like, what size of a building can we put up? How much can we charge? Like, what's the revenue stream going to look like?
Developer Smith will try to understand all the different costs to get her condo built. This is based on the city and how expensive it is to build and design in Ottawa.
They'll look at the building cost. They'll look at the what's called soft costs. There are hard costs, which are the costs associated with the physical construction of the building. Then there's soft costs, which are basically all the supporting actors, like planners, architects, lawyers. And they also will look at how much the municipal regulations are going to cost them in terms of development charges, the park dedication fee.
Then Ms. Smith will combine the revenue side with the costs.
Put together a rough cut of what they think it's going to deliver in terms of a profit for them, usually based on something called the internal rate of return.
At this point, the developer has enough information to go to City Hall.
They'll meet with the planners and present an initial proposal, and the planning staff will come back with their comments, whether, you know, in terms of the scale, in terms of the types of uses they're proposing.
Now, it might get a little political at this point.
The local politician, the area politician, will likely get involved at some point and voice their concerns or voice their desires or even voice their support for a project.
From here, it becomes a matter of negotiation, a bit of a liar's poker. How badly does that developer want this project? How much is the city willing to give in terms of density?
And then it just becomes a back and forth. And once that's done, then the negotiation really from the developer side focuses on the pro forma. The biggest concern is the battle over density. How much can be built on the site? The more revenue generating space there is, the better it is for the developer. Again, and it's tied back to the land. So the density is a big one. And that's tied into site plan issues, setbacks, and all these other park, like open space requirements, if you want. So there's just how much buildable site, how much buildable land or area there is on the site that will dictate density as well. The heights are an issue as well. Sometimes it's the uses. They don't want certain, like the community doesn't want certain uses.
So there you have it. Stephen Weber, a registered professional planner and professor at Ryerson, has just taken us through the basics of a pro forma in 5 minutes. It's not so mysterious, but important for planners to understand as they think about zoning and land use policies, all the things that affect the developer's sacred rate of return.
And also, I think it's in part, there's still a mentality that planners feel like they don't need to know. Right? From the planner's perspective, as this is good city building policy, and this is what we want, you know, and the developers make lots of money, so they'll just have to adhere to these guidelines in order to build in our community. So I don't want to say they're all like that, but I think there's still a sense of planners don't think that that's part of their thought process. That's something the developers have to worry about.
Set me free. Set me free. Everyone I love is untethered by desire. set me free, set me free. 'Cause everyone I love is untethered by desire. Behest of my sons, I'm inviting all my time. 'Cause I've been afraid to tell you so. As the ocean breathes all the life beneath, far beyond your reach and all your dreams.
Let's scale back a bit. So how do our policies affect what developers build at a macro scale? Are they actually having an effect?
So we have the Places to Grow plan series that tries to direct growth, particularly to the already built up area. So we have in that plan intensification targets, where you're supposed to have 40% of all new residential development in the already built up area. So that's one of the primary objectives, is making better use of our existing urban area.
This infill and intensification is called brownfield or greyfield development. On the other side of the ring road, we have greenfield development. That's building on undeveloped land, like agricultural land or forests. When you look at the policies planners are creating, the party for greenfield development seems to be winding down.
So achieving higher densities where you do have to have greenfields development, that there's some minimum densities there, and mixed use. So, you know, those are the kind of pillars, I guess, of a kind of compact urban form, more dense, more mixed. And that's kind of the sort of planning framework. And that gets parlayed down to the different levels of planning. So from the provincial plan, provincial growth plan, down to the regional plan, down to the local municipal plans, and finally down to implemented on the ground and secondary plans.
On the other side, we have the financial drivers, or the price signals. Local governments set all these different prices that affect the market. And these signals really affect the decisions of developers.
So development always takes place in a market. You know, we have a land market and a development market. And decisions there are influenced by prices. And the government, both at the local level, provincial level, and federal level, they basically set prices through things like tax policy and the way that they set their user fees, the way that they set development charges. Those end up essentially being prices that influence decision making about where to build, when to build, how densely to build, you know, what forms of building to build. Those are influenced by, you know, market factors. And the policies, let's just use the example at the local level, they have development charges, which are charges that are meant to recover the cost of infrastructure for new growth. They have property taxes, which essentially set a price that you pay every year for a certain kind of property, and user fees. So that's either for garbage pickup, for example, it could be for recreation centers, and also sometimes with respect to municipal utilities, if there's a municipal utility for water, for example.
Development charges are fees collected from developers by municipalities. Essentially, the city creates a formula based on the square footage of building. When a developer applies to build 5 houses, the city uses the formula to determine the development charge based on the combined square footage of the homes. This money collected goes directly into covering the costs of city roads, sidewalks, sewer pipes, and parks, and whatever other infrastructure is needed for those 5 homes. Many cities are relying heavily on these development charges to finance the capital costs of new infrastructure. But in many cities today, these charges don't take the location or form of a development into account.
The way that development charges for non-residential are set up, you pay per square foot of building or per square meter. So if you have a certain lot, say it's 1 hectare, the more building you put on it, the more you're charged. So in other words, the more densely you build, the more you pay. So particularly for a multi-story building, I mean, most of the cost of servicing a building is about servicing, you know, the first floor, but that is bringing all the pipes and the roads and everything to that actual site. The incremental cost of adding floors, you know, goes down and down and down as you go up for linear infrastructure, and that is, you know, the biggest part. So they're basically penalizing multi-story buildings for on the non-residential side. It's kind of a built-in disincentive to densify when the policy says we want more dense.
Perverse, a definition. Showing a deliberate and obstinate desire to behave in a way that is unreasonable or unacceptable, often in spite of the consequences.
So the cost of infrastructure vary depending on where that development takes place. If it's in an already urban area, the costs are generally lower because you already have roads in place, you already have parks in place, you already have sewer and water systems in place, compared to greenfields where all that has to be created from scratch. And also density. So denser urban forms tend to be more efficient and lower cost per unit, simply because for all that linear kind of infrastructure, you need less of it if you have a denser pattern. But development charges, for example, don't take that into account. You pay the same development charge if your house is on a 20-foot lot or a 60-foot lot or a 70-foot lot. It doesn't matter. So that makes developers, for example, indifferent. Like, they don't bear the real costs of the infrastructure through the development charge. For them, they pay the same price whether they're building a house on a 70-foot lot or a 20-foot lot. So it kind of neutralizes the actual cost differences between those two types, and it encourages developers to build a larger lot rather than a compact lot.
Pamela Blay is a registered professional planner and the principal of Metropole Consultants. In her recent book, Perverse Cities, Hidden Subsidies, Wonky Policy, and Urban Sprawl, she shows how our current financial mechanisms work against planning policy and encourage sprawl.
Planning policy says, let's densify, and the price signals say, let's promote less dense development.
She says that this disconnect between the planning policies and the price signals is undermining our municipalities' ability to achieve environmental and economic sustainability. So how much money could we actually save by building more densely?
Typically, it shows you can save somewhere between 20 to 60% on infrastructure costs by actually getting a more efficient development pattern and compact development. But we're not really doing that right now.
A chance to save half of the cost of infrastructure could save municipalities millions. That could mean putting those millions back into the city for things like transit, parks, and libraries.
There's indirect costs as well. So that would be things like congestion costs, for example, that are associated with the low-density auto-dependent development pattern. In the GTA, those are estimated at about $10 to $11 billion a year at the moment. Then there's some of the other external costs like air pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, loss of farmland through urbanization at the edge.
So how do we fix our perverse system?
How you would fix this problem is that the development charges that are set would much more closely reflect the costs that different kinds of development incur to the municipality. So what happens now is the denser stuff, the denser development, is subsidizing the less dense development. And the development that takes place within the already urban area subsidizes the greenfields development. And those subsidies are built in because the prices are averaged or uniform and the costs are not. Those subsidies are basically built into the development charge. So a developer's response is going to depend on which side of that equation he sits or she sits at the moment. So if it's somebody who builds mostly denser, you know, infill, they would definitely benefit by having this fixed. But it's not actually a kind of one for one thing. I have actually done an estimate of if you did base the charges more accurately on density and location, how much of an adjustment there would be. And essentially what happens is the dense development in already urban areas goes down quite a bit, and the cost for the, or the development charge cost for the greenfields development would go up a bit. So it's not like a complete reversal or a complete, you know, one for one exchange. There's a small upward adjustment. So, and for municipalities, what it would mean is they get a more efficient development pattern.
What is sprawl anyway?
Well, I mean, the major differences there are that suburban environments tend to be very low density. Even now, in the, you know, Toronto area, we're seeing still relatively low density development at the fringe on greenfields lands. Residential development is usually separated from employment areas, particularly office parks and business parks. You know, these are things that don't really exist, you know, in the existing built-up area. And then in terms of what goes on in the urban area, it's denser. It tends to be more mixed. The scale is a lot smaller. The streets are more connected. Tends to be, you know, mid-rise buildings, or in the downtown in Toronto, obviously there's a huge high-rise boom going on there. So it's not only the building type, but also the urban pattern in terms of the density and street layout and the mixing of uses.
Does this remind you of anywhere?
Good afternoon. I'm John McKenzie, the Commissioner of Planning for the City of Vaughan.
McKenzie, a registered professional planner, has been finding that even cities with intentions of urbanizing face the challenge of our perverse system.
You know, I think it's particularly important with respect to the whole growth plan for the Greater Golden Horseshoe, because they have, you know, density incentives that, or density policies for minimum greenfield densities, and also minimum densities for the centers, urban growth centers, and the intensification targets. These kinds of incentives are really undermining each and every one of those policies.
One of the things that we found very challenging is that we're now, as a municipality, tasked with trying to provide an urban environment in what was historically a greenfield community in the city of Vaughan. So this has been traditionally a low-density area. It's urbanized rapidly in a low-density form. The way that the Development Charges Act is structured in Ontario is that your development charges are based on the historic levels of service. So they're based on, in the city of Vaughan, largely an traditional lower density form of development. And so they take those historic levels of service, average it out, and that becomes your development charge and what is a supportable development charge under the Act.
But in Vaughan, like some other suburban municipalities in Ontario, they're shifting away from business as usual and trying to build up at their center instead of sprawling.
There's a potential issue as a lot of the municipalities are getting more mature. So we see this now in Mississauga, for example. So Mississauga just recently ran out of greenfields. Now they have to look inward. So they need to find, in Peel Region, which is responsible for the major sort of regional level infrastructure, there's still greenfields development happening in Peel Region. But they're faced with expanding at the urban edge, and now the older areas are getting to the age where that infrastructure is going to need to be replaced or fixed. So, you know, you're kind of getting two types of costs at the same time, potentially, in those municipalities. So there is the opportunity to think about how can we, through reurbanization, address the issue of fixing the aging infrastructure at the same time as we're accommodating new growth there. So you can kind of kill two birds with one stone.
Vaughan has seized this opportunity. They are pioneering new strategies for municipalities to start retrofitting their suburbs.
What is the story of Vaughan? And that's an incredible story of rapid growth. Vaughan has grown from a township of 15,000 people in 1971 to a city now of 320,000. And we're now forecasted, as part of our official plan review, to take us and Markham are going to take the lion's share of growth in the region of York as per the growth plan amendment number 2. So we may be tasked with accommodating a population of 500,000 people by 2041. That's in the range of what we're looking at right now in order to conform to the growth plan. The city's evolved very quickly from a community of these 4 distinct historic villages. There was Kleinberg, there was Woodbridge, there was Old Thornhill, and there was Old Maple, into a very international community, very welcoming of immigrants. It's a city that speaks 99 languages and has an incredible amount of diversity from all over the world. What we're trying to do in the city now, and it's very exciting because we're blessed with the only new subway that's coming to the 905 region, is that we're trying to create a place where people live, work, and play in a new downtown environment.
The perfect storm of regional transit investment and the growth pressure has led to the vision for Vaughan Metropolitan Center, or the VMC, a new walkable transit-oriented downtown for the city of Vaughan. The city has taken this vision seriously, upzoning the areas within the VMC to accommodate the future growth, which Pamela says can streamline the development process and save municipalities a lot of money in the short term and long term.
So municipalities strategically identify where they want to see the growth. And then before they get the development application for the, 40-story building, they go in with the community and figure out a plan proactively for that whole area, not on a site-by-site basis, but for that whole area, and then proactively rezone it. Then I think that would help a lot, because then the framework is in place and then developers can come in and, with, say, site plan review, more easily get a building permit.
By establishing the zoning, getting community support, and detailing the built form and how it transitions into existing neighborhoods, cities create a more straightforward and less risky process for developers. It's a win-win, and that's exactly what they're doing in Vaughan.
At this point in time, we have created a plan that will accommodate at least 1.5 million square foot of office, 750,000 square feet of retail, 12,000 residential units that will house over 25,000 people. The area is a mobility hub, anchor mobility hub in the growth plan. It's also designated as a urban growth centers in the growth plan. And so we're already on track to achieve density targets of 200 plus people and jobs per hectare. And we're moving towards that. So it's an exciting place. We've got some buildings going up right now, and the subway is going to arrive by the end of 2017. And I'm being conservative and fingers crossed. And I think we're working with everyone to make sure that happens.
The city is on track to get the kind of progressive development they have written up in their policies. Mixed-use buildings will look out onto new parks, public spaces, and tree-lined streets. Buildings will embrace sustainable building practices and green energy sources. But one of the most important factors in shifting to a more urban development pattern is changing infrastructure priorities.
I think part of the thing that they have to do is to look at their infrastructure plans with respect to a change in the development pattern. So what happens sometimes is that municipalities keep spending a lot of money on road infrastructure, even though there's this idea that we should be switching to a more transit-supportive form. So the transit kind of gets added on as another cost, rather than looking at, now we're switching our form to something that's more compact. Do we actually need to continue that same level of road spending? And so those two things have to be really brought in line with one another as well.
Instead of being an added cost, transit is at the center of the transformation. The new downtown will be anchored by a new subway station, the most northern link on the TTC. It will also be a hub for the new Viva dedicated bus lanes that connect Markham, Vaughan, and Richmond Hill, and the New York Region Transit Bus Terminal. Transit users will arrive in a place that will make walking and cycling to their destination easy. But in order to pay for transit infrastructure, Vaughan has made the decision to reduce spending on infrastructure that caters to a drive-first mentality.
We've reduced the parking standards through a comprehensive bylaw, so that creates a situation where, you know, we're not asking people to build, to overbuild on the parking. We're coming up with opportunities for people to share.
If you keep spending the same amount on roads and keep building basically the same road system, then it's going to be very difficult to support and attract riders onto transit. So that's another sort of related issue. So again, there are potential savings as long as, you know, when municipalities are looking at making the shift to a more compact urban form, they look at all the aspects. So where are we investing our money? How are we charging for our development charges and our property tax and our user fees? And what do our planning policies say? You really need, those are like the three pieces of the puzzle, I think, that have to all be brought together to actually make the compact urban form actually happen.
Well, all this sounds great, but how are they going to pay for it? Vaughan got a major boost from federal and provincial governments for the transit infrastructure because of the regional importance of the VMC. But paying for the new buildings, public spaces, major utility and infrastructure updates, and community facilities is mostly on the shoulders of the municipality.
What will emerge from all this is a whole suite of tools that will be used to help achieve what we're looking for in this area. I mean, this is a large area. So imagine trying to develop all of downtown Toronto at once. So you just can't do it. And so what we're trying to do is prioritize our funding tools and working with the development community. We're aligning our capital projects as a city with development and, most importantly, with the transit investment. So at this point, the city is prioritizing the funding or the cost sharing of projects with the region and with the developers in those areas where we're experiencing those first development applications.
They've also been collecting development charges across the whole municipality to cover the cost of the new public infrastructure in the VMC. So instead of brownfield development subsidizing greenfield development is subsidizing brownfield development and actually reinforcing the city's policy priorities.
We've been collecting citywide development charges and working with the region to assess how those citywide development charges can be applied in the Vaughan Metropolitan Center to help us get the public infrastructure we need to get in order to support that upcoming population. So, for example, we have a citywide development charge for parks. We have a citywide development charge for our public works and infrastructure and some of our stormwater works that we're using. And we're looking to leverage those funds, work with the private sector, and see what they can bring to the table in terms of their site-specific projects.
They are also looking at staggering the development charges. Developers may be willing to pay more back to the city over a longer term instead of a lump sum up front.
For example, if you do have an office project, we are looking at opportunity to create a more staggered approach where you could have payment in phases.
Like Pamela, John has come to realize some flaws in the underlying financial structures and provincial legislation that impact a city's ability to realize a more transit-oriented development pattern.
That changed the Development Charge Act, which allows development, potentially, to pay for more of the share of transit. That one change could help make transit more viable over the long term. So I think planners, as an organization, interprofessional planners or other organizations, we really have to focus a little bit more on some of those acts and some of those traditional acts and see if we can make some changes, because those smaller changes to that system may help us create a better platform for developing these cities.
A lot of these gaps come down to a silo issue. Planners aren't always aware of how financial structure is undermining their policy, and financial people are often unaware of how their structure affects planning. Planners are in one corner, and finance people are in another. And they don't talk much. Literally.
I once went to a town, and they asked me to come, and the environment office called and said, we'd like you to come and talk about this. I said, okay. And I knew that that town were reviewing their development charges bylaw at that time, which is the perfect opportunity to change things. And so I asked the person who called me, well, do you know who's doing this? And he said, no, I don't know the person in charge of reviewing the development charges bylaw. And so I found out. It turned out it was the person who sat in the cubicle next to him.
This conundrum also played out in Vaughan.
The whole funding formula for schools is based on a traditional suburban two-story template school on 5 acres. In the Vaughan Metropolitan Center, 5 acres in the right location could cost you $35 million. You're not, as a public body, going to acquire that land very easily in such a location. There's too many demands on that same piece of real estate. So I think what the province, and we're encouraging them, the school boards and us collaborate quite closely on this, is to look at different approaches for these urban centers and potentially tweaking those provincial funding models, for example, on those schools, to incent a more urban approach.
The simple act of locating a school and community center together turned out to be a lot more complicated than they had anticipated.
As a planner, as a professional planner, I think it's been eye-opening to me to get behind the scenes, and I'm just trying to create a more efficient, co-located urban school. I'm just looking to try to get a community center and a school built in relatively the same location or potentially co-located, so that way we can efficiently use infrastructure. And it's really opened my mind up to all of these challenging systemic issues that really are opportunities for planners to advocate for change.
One of the main reasons Vaughan has been able to move so quickly is because they are bringing many voices to the table and building consensus from the get-go.
It's been a fantastic exercise in having a cross-departmental initiative where we brought in finance, we brought in engineering, we brought in parks development, we brought in all of the different groups of the city. We brought in legal, real estate groups. We brought in all these people, and under the leadership of Tim Simmons and our team from the Vaughan Metropolitan Center group that's working on this, and Andrew Pierce and Paul Jankowski, we had a facilitated process that got the landowners around the table, got them engaged, and now we're working on trying to come up with a strategy to implement the project in phases.
The project has shifted Vaughan's perspective on the role of the planner. More than anything, it's an exercise in orchestrating people, places, and money to create a whole that is greater than the sum of the parts.
A planner becomes now a great connector of dots. So 1, 2, 3, 4, and now we've got York Region Rapid Transit going on, and they've got to design their new bus terminal that's all connected, and we're all vertically integrated, and it's all connected. So there is the potential for something great, but there's also the potential that it's going to be disjointed if you don't coordinate it all. So I think what we're finding as planners, we find ourselves in this exciting opportunity now of having to coordinate all these different things. So the transit square can help, the funding for the transit square can be coordinated with the funding for the bus terminal, which can be coordinated with our design and streetscape improvements on Millway Avenue, which then can become the potential for one of our first places in the Vaughan Metropolitan Center that's really put together and composed in a nice way and becomes a good environment.
In part two of this episode, we'll hear stories from people and cities who are fighting the odds. Without a lot of capital, they're using innovative financial tools to build cities, social capital, and a better future for their communities. That's Planning with Sense, part two. I'm Danielle Davis. Stay tuned.
You've been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a Planning and Design Center production. This episode was created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordy Gordon, Joel Sajunki, and me, Ross Soward. This was an OPPI episode. For more Cities Alive episodes, subscribe to Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca. The music in this episode is from Canadian artists who allowed us to use their great songs. Please check out Rover, Hooded Fang, Ostrich Tuning, and Golden Youth for more.